Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 218, Smorgasbord, October 2022. Everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, learning new things, having fun. And today we've got a smorgasbord episode lined up, which means we're going to be tackling a few different topics in today's episode, not least of which is one of my favorite things to do during smorgasbord episodes, and that is a cookbook review and a cookbook giveaway. So we're going to be doing the review and the giveaway in the second half of the show. So definitely stick around for that. Who doesn't like to win free cookbooks, really? And then other topics we're going to cover today, what I think is going to be my new go-to side dish for Thanksgiving this year. I just went out to dinner tonight. I discovered this dish and I am going to make that. I'm really excited about it. I'm also going to talk about stainless steel cookware and something called the Leiden Frost Effect. That sounds mysterious, doesn't it? I want to get your thoughts on squash. And then, yeah, that'll actually segue then right into our cookbook and our cookbook review and giveaway. So stick around for that. Before we jump into all the good stuff, a quick bit of housekeeping, of course. First things first, the show notes for this episode will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/218. Again, that's kitchencounterpodcast.com/218. Pop that into your favorite web browser and that will take you over to the page that will have links and other information from this specific episode. So if you hear me talk about something, and I tell you, I'm going to link to it, like an article we'll talk about, for example, or a link to the cookbook we're going to be giving away if you want to check that out, or maybe you don't want to, maybe you don't feel lucky and you just want to go buy it. I'll give you a link for that too. So kitchencounterpodcast.com/218. If you want to get a hold of me directly, send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. I'm also on most of the social medias lurking around. You can find all the links to that in the show notes as well. So I would just head over to the show notes page or the main website, and you can find all that good stuff. The Kitchen Counter Podcast is a proud member of the Nitty Grits Podcast, which is a network of shows out of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, shows specifically about food, drink, and culture. If you want to learn more about the Nitty Grits Network or the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, head over to southernfood.org. All right, you've got the show notes link. You know where to find me. Let's jump right into this smorgasbord episode for October 2022. So my wife and I found ourselves kidless this evening. My son, who's a fifth grader, had the opportunity to go to a sleepover at a friend's house. And so he's there. We had some free time. We're like, well, let's go to dinner. We rarely get to do that by ourselves anymore. And so, yeah, so that's what we did earlier today. And it actually completely inspired this first part of the show I want to talk about, which I wasn't even planning on talking about, but I thought, oh, I've got to share this. This was so good. Now, we were looking around for a place to eat, and we don't eat out that much without our son. I mean, we don't eat out that much with our son, but without our son, just the two of us, we don't get out to restaurants all that often. So I kind of even forget what's around town. We know our favorites and the routine stops, but we wanted to do something new. So what do you do when you need to find a new place to eat? Well, I went to Yelp, of course, and I just started searching for restaurants in our town. All the usual suspects were there. There were a few new ones. I didn't know, what cuisine I was in the mood for. My wife didn't really know. We were just kind of looking. And we came across a new restaurant that opened up a few months ago. I hadn't even heard about it, but it's a new Spanish tapas place in town. And there used to be a Spanish small plates tapas place in town years ago that we loved going to, and it closed down. So we've been a little bit without here locally. But this new place opened up. It's called the Cozy Taberna. and it got good reviews. It looked good. So we decided to make a reservation, and that's where we had dinner. So long story getting around to this. You know, a tapas place is like small plates. You know, you just order whatever looks good off the menu, and they bring you a plate or two at a time, and you just kind of munch and drink wine or sangria or water or whatever it is you want while you're enjoying yourself munching on these small plates. One small plate was fried Brussels sprouts, so that sounded good, so we ordered that. And I didn't even read the fine print on the menu, but it was tossed with, well, according to the menu, a Saigon caramel. And I assume by Saigon caramel, they meant Vietnamese caramel. I'm assuming that's the same thing. There might have been a variation. We had a lot of good food, cheeses. I mean, lots of good food. But I have to almost admit that the Brussels sprouts were maybe the best thing I ate. I could have eaten a whole another plate full of them. So they were Brussels sprouts cut in half, deep fried until they were tender in the middle and just crispy on the outer edges. So the outer leaves were kind of crunchy and crispy. And then it was tossed with this Saigon caramel sauce. And the sweetness of the sauce and the bitterness of the Brussels sprouts and, you know, the little bit of salt they seasoned it with, it was an incredible, incredible bite of food. Like I said, I could have eaten plates of them, and I think I'm really going to try to recreate it for a Thanksgiving side this year, because I'm always looking for a different side with some green vegetables. Now, granted, green vegetables, you know, drizzled with a sweet, savory sauce might not be the most healthy thing, but it's Thanksgiving dinner, right? I'm not trying to help anybody lose weight on Thanksgiving. So I think I'm going to give it a shot. I think it's going to be good. Now, some of you might be thinking, why would you put caramel sauce on Brussels sprouts? That sounds terrible. Well, Vietnamese caramel sauce is a little bit different than the caramel sauce you and I might ordinarily think of, like you might drizzle on some ice cream or make brittle out of or something like that. So caramel sauce is typically sugar, water, cooked together until the sugar turns an amber color and caramelizes, turns into a caramel sauce. And then it's usually, for sweet applications, it's usually finished with some cream, and that's the caramel sauce you and I are used to drizzling on our vanilla ice cream, for example. A Vietnamese caramel sauce is different. It's also sugar. It's also water. Typically, it's cooked a little bit longer than a regular caramel sauce, so where you might stop making your own sauce, it's sort of an amber, kind of a hay or a straw color for your caramel sauce. With a Vietnamese sauce, you'd go a step farther and make it a little darker, more toffee-colored or coffee-colored. It's still sweet, but it starts to turn just bittersweet. If you cook caramel sauce too long, it'll get bitter. But you're looking with a Vietnamese caramel sauce, just putting your toe over the edge into bitterness, and then you end up with this really interesting sauce that you can use for all sorts of savory applications. You mix it in with braises and you can cook chicken in it. You can do all sorts of really good stuff with this Vietnamese style caramel sauce. And it's really fantastic on the fried Brussels sprouts. So I just wanted to share that. I'm going to try to come up with a recipe. I think it'll be fairly simple, but I'm going to come up with a recipe. And when I do, I'll post it. But I think I'm definitely making it for Thanksgiving this year. I know I've said it before, but I'm telling you, going out to eat, it's not cheap these days, but when you can do it, if you can go to a different sort of a place than you're used to going, you'll almost always be inspired somehow. And there was a lot on this menu for this tapas place that was really inspiring, but sometimes the most simple things are the best. Okay, let's move on. Here's the stuff I had planned to talk about in today's episode. I want to talk for a few minutes about cookware, and specifically stainless steel cookware. I was looking into some information on pots, pans, all that kind of stuff. I wanted to do an episode kind of in the same vein as the knife episode I did a couple shows back, and I probably will still do that, but I wanted to talk for a few minutes today specifically about stainless steel cookware. In my research, it seems like it gets a lot of less love than a lot of the other types of cookwares, like cast iron or enameled cast iron or carbon steel or any other various nonstick or even like hard anodized aluminum. It seems like stainless steel, for whatever reason, has a bad rap about stickiness, and it's not great for food to not stick as you cook because you're always scrubbing these stainless steel pans, and it's just kind of a pain. And all these other pans produce a surface that don't stick as much and don't require as much scrubbing and cleaning. And that can be true, certainly. In fact, when I started cooking in earnest years and years and years ago, I kind of avoided stainless steel pans because I felt like the few times I had used them, they were a mess to clean. The food always stuck to them, and it just made cooking with stainless steel not very fun. At least it seemed like it at the time. These days, I almost always reach for stainless steel when I'm cooking something in a skillet or in a sauté pan. Don't get me wrong, I like cast iron, I like carbon steel, I've got those as well, but stainless steel for me is the biggest bang for the buck as far as durability and ruggedness. It's not reactive, it doesn't take a whole lot of care to keep the pans in good shape like some of the other materials do. So for me, a good stainless steel pan is the way to go. Now, what about this sticking problem? Or this reputation of stainless steel for not being fun to cook with? Well, it got me to thinking, and I want to talk for a few minutes about that, because if you have stainless steel cookware, or if you're thinking about getting some, but you're kind of on the fence about it, I want to talk about, well, what we're going to talk about eventually here is called the Leidenfrost effect, but it's simply about heat when it comes to using stainless steel cookware. Now, not all of the things I'm going to talk about are exclusively issues or quirks of stainless steel, but certainly we're going to focus on stainless steel. I think a lot of the problem that folks have when cooking with stainless, especially with the sticking food problem, is they're not doing probably a couple things. They're not definitely getting their pan to the proper temperature before they start cooking. And also, they might be cooking food that's too cold, like they're For example, I'm just going to use, going through this, an example of a boneless, skinless chicken breast, because it's just an easy example. If you ever cooked a boneless, skinless chicken breast in a stainless steel skillet, at some point or another, you've probably run into the problem where you're like scraping the spatula under the chicken, trying to get it to come off of the stainless steel, and it kind of rips and shreds as you pull it off because it's just so stuck. Well, if you actually start with a cool pan and a cool product like a boneless skinless chicken breast that's right out of the fridge, and let's say you put that pan on the burner or on the flame, you put the chicken breast right into the pan at the same time, and as you heat both of those up, as they both come up in temperature, this is kind of a weird thing, the protein in the chicken will have a tendency to bond with some of the elements in that pan, particularly the iron. So the protein in the chicken will bond with the iron, and that's what causes the real bad sticking. That happens when you heat a pan and a protein up when they're both cool and you heat them up together in the pan. Even if you have a pan that's somewhat preheated, if you take a really cold boneless, skinless chicken breast right out of the refrigerator, or even worse, right out of the freezer, and throw it in the pan, it almost has the same effect, because that cold chicken breast will actually instantly lower the surface temperature of that pan when it hits it, and you can get the same phenomena happening where the proteins will bond with the pan, and then you get this bad sticking problem. And of course, you're using some sort of an oil or a fat too, I get it, but it still happens. So one of the best ways you can counteract that problem is to make sure that you heat up your stainless steel skillet, in this example, up to a very high temperature before you add your oil or your fat and whatever it is you're cooking. There's a couple of reasons for this. One, in a cool or a cold stainless steel pan, the surface is porous. Now, you can't see it with your naked eye, but microscopically, it has pretty large pores in the surface of the metal when it's cool. As it heats up, those pores shrink, and that gives less surface area, at least microscopically, for your food to cling to the pan. That's the least important of the two reasons. The most important reason is something that is generally referred to as the Leidenfrost effect. And understanding this is a key to making your stainless steel cookware work better for you. So imagine you take that stainless steel skillet, you put it on a cold burner, and you turn the burner on so that your skillet can heat. Now let's imagine every 30 seconds, whatever the interval is, I don't know what you're heating it on. If it's on over a flame, it might heat up faster than, say, on a ceramic cooktop. But let's say every so often you're taking a drop of water and you're dropping it in the pan. Now, when you drop the water in right away, it's just going to sit there. The pan's not barely even warm, let alone hot, and the water won't do anything. It'll just sit there in a little blob. So let's say you wait a few more, like another 30 seconds, and you put another drop of water in the pan. It might sizzle or bubble very slightly because the pan's now a little bit hotter, and it will eventually probably evaporate or steam away. As the pan gets hotter and you keep testing it with drops of water, you'll notice that pretty soon the pan's going to be so hot when the drop of water hits it, it's just going to sizzle away and boil off almost immediately. That's hot, but it's still not hot enough for your food. And as the pan keeps getting hotter and you keep testing it with water, and you don't have to do this every time you cook, you'll get a feel for it. I mean, you can use the water drop test, but as you get a feel for it, you'll understand how long it takes for your pans to preheat, depending on your stove and your materials and things like that. But after a while, you would think as the pan gets hotter, the water would just, as it hits the surface of the pan, it would just boil off faster and faster and faster until it gets so hot it would like instantly vaporize, right? Well, interestingly, it achieves something called the Leidenfrost effect. And it's almost counterintuitive, but when it gets that hot, when you put a drop of water in the pan, instead of the water sizzling and boiling off immediately, it will actually hit the surface of that pan, bounce around, and it will skitter around in a nice little ball of water, like a little hockey puck around the surface of that pan, bouncing off the sides, and it won't boil off right away. It'll take quite a while for it to eventually boil away. That is a demonstration of the Leidenfrost effect. And it's only called that because it's named after somebody who observed the phenomenon, wrote about it, I think, back in the mid-1700s. But what the Leidenfrost effect basically says is that when you have a liquid and that liquid comes into contact with a surface that is many times higher in temperature than the boiling point of that liquid, rather than just boil away or steam away instantly, when the liquid hits that surface, layer of vapor instantly appears between the surface and the liquid, and it actually insulates that droplet of liquid, and it regulates the temperature between the surface and that droplet of liquid to a temperature where it just cannot boil off very rapidly, and that's you get this phenomena where this little droplet of water bounces around the surface of your skillet. When it gets to that point, when it gets to that temperature, that's a great time to put the oil or the fat, whatever you're using, and then the food, in this case, the chicken breasts, for the example, into the skillet. That's a great temperature because even though when you put the chicken breast in at that point, it's not going to dance and slide around the surface of the skillet like that droplet of water did, it will still take advantage of some of that Leidenfrost effect phenomena. Some of that liquid will vaporize instantly that's associated with that chicken breast, and it will create a barrier between the hot surface of the skillet and the proteins of that chicken breast. It will help insulate it, and it will help create, I won't say like a non-stick barrier, but it helps prevent that chicken breast from sticking to the surface of the pan because it's actually insulated with that thin layer of moisture vapor. It's a very easy thing to test for yourself if you have a stainless steel skillet. Actually, I think it would work with any metal skillet that you could get hot enough. The Leidenfrost effect with water, I don't know if anyone knows the exact temperature, but it's somewhere in the upper 300s Fahrenheit, like 370, 380 before the Leidenfrost effect really kicks in. And of course, the boiling point of water is 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So that 380, 390 is much higher in temperature. That's when the effect occurs. Now, you don't have to remember all of that when it comes to cooking. You can just heat up your stainless steel pan. You use the water drop test as I described it, and I will put a video in the show notes that explain the water drop effect as well. It's a very simple test to do. I do it all the time when I'm searing proteins, especially in a stainless steel pan, whether that's, you know, a salmon fillet or a chicken breast or a steak or whatever. I'm always heating the pan up, and then I'm testing it with the water drops until it starts dancing around in a nice little blob. I know that's when I quickly wipe the water out of there, throw my fat in, and then sear off whatever it is I'm cooking. So if you've got stainless steel cookware that you don't like to use because you've never had a good experience with food sticking to it, or if you're thinking about picking up a stainless steel piece of cookware but you're not sure about it, again, I love stainless steel because it's very low maintenance. And no, it will never be as nonstick as like a Teflon pan. You're never going to be able to crack an egg in a stainless steel skillet, fry it up, and then like slide it out onto a plate. That's probably never going to happen like it can with some of your other pans like cast iron or Teflon coated. But when it comes to searing and sautéing, this is a good technique to keep in mind. Well, where I live, it's squash season, deep into it. And of course, I guess we're really in the middle of squash season if you consider there's summer squash varieties, which are your zucchinis, your crookneck squash, your patty pans, you go to the store and you just see those yellow squash that are just generically labeled summer squash. And those are the thin-skinned variety of squash, right? They don't last very long. They're very perishable. And they're more of a summer, late summer crop. And then you've got your other squash, which are like your autumn and your winter squash, which would be the hardier, thicker squashes, more like your gourds. Those would be your butternut squash, acorn squash, spaghetti squash, pumpkins, and those types of varieties. And in the past, I have to admit, I have not really embraced squash. I don't find winter squash, at least, to be among my favorite type of winter vegetables. I love summer squash. I love zucchini. And I don't know why necessarily, other than I think the summer squash obviously are a little more tender. They take less work to cook. And for whatever reason, I tend to associate the summer squash varieties with more savory dishes and preparations, where the winter squash varieties I always kind of associate with sweeter or spicier preparations. But as I said, while I really like summer squash and those varieties, I really have a hard time with the winter squash. Aside from, you know, the very standard ways you see to prepare them, which are roasting them in the oven until they get soft and then treating them with some warm spice mixture and eating them that way, or some sort of pureed preparation like butternut squash soup. And those don't really do that much for me. They're all right, but I don't crave them. I don't seek them out. I don't really look forward to making those. So I've been trying to figure out a way to get more excited about squash. I don't know, maybe you have some thoughts on especially winter squash. Would love to hear it. But in that quest to figure out like what can I do with squash that would excite me, I have to talk about this cookbook I came across. And before I get into this, so of course you know that squash is indigenous to the Western Hemisphere. It's a very important crop for indigenous Americans, and squash is widely referred to as one of the three sisters crops, which would be squash, and then beans and corn as the other two sisters. So I thought maybe I should simplify the quest for answers when it comes to me liking squash more and looking more forward to making it. So I came across this book. Now, this cookbook is a couple years old, and there's other similar types of books like it, but I do not own a cookbook like this, so I had to pick this up. This one is called The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, and this is by Sean Sherman with Beth Dooley, and it's a bit of a pun. The Sous Chef, Sioux is spelled S-I-O-U-X, as in the Sioux Nation. So the Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. This book is really a fascinating survey, I guess, at least for somebody like me who's not really familiar with indigenous cuisine. This is a fascinating survey of indigenous ingredients, indigenous foodways, at least from the Midwest, Minnesota, the Dakotas, that area of the United States. Now, Sean Sherman, who's the primary author of this book, is an Oglala Lakota Sioux, and he was born in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. He's been cooking all around that region, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Montana, for probably over 30 years now. He's a caterer, a food educator, and he wrote this book to bring to the forefront the indigenous foodways, ingredients, and things like that. It's really an interesting book. And of course, squash figures prominently throughout the book. But I want to talk about the book a little bit because it kind of sidetracked me off the whole squash question. Although I will say, I think I'm going to try roasting up some squash and maybe tossing it with a little bit of that Vietnamese caramel like I talked about at the beginning with the Brussels sprouts. I think that could be pretty good. So as I look through the Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, it's arranged around really the bounty of the lands that he's writing about, the Northern Plains. And it's full of stories and recipes and notes on interesting indigenous ingredients. Ingredients that I'm not familiar with and I probably couldn't get a hold of if, even if I wanted to. For example, hopness, which is a ground nut. It's a tuber from a bean plant that tastes kind of like a russet potato, yucca, and raw peanut combined. You're not going to find those probably in your grocery store. Maybe in that region you can find some of that sort of stuff. Sunchokes, teosinte, cattails, stagthorn, sumac, all sorts of interesting ingredients. If you're interested in foraging, these would be interesting to learn about and check out some of the recipes. Now, the great thing about this book is even with the more hard-to-find ingredients, they provide recipes that use those ingredients, but also provide reasonable substitutions that are of ingredients that are generally available to the home cook. Some of these are just for general information. I don't even think there's a recipe that has cattails in it in this book, but he does talk a little bit about how cattails are an important foraged food source for a North Plains tribes. But some of these ingredients are available online as well as well-stocked supermarkets like amaranth and a variety of proteins from fish to lots of duck and goose, lots of bison recipes, rabbit recipes as well in this cookbook. And throughout this book, there's something beautiful about the simplicity of these recipes. These are, in many cases, subsistence recipes, though delicious. So here's simple corn cakes with assorted toppings. I mean, this is a four-ingredient recipe: water, salt, cornmeal or polenta, and sunflower or nut oil. Very, very simple recipes. There's lots of recipes that use various types of flour. There's wild rice cakes, which are, again, very simple. Cooked wild rice, water, salt, a little bit of maple sugar, and sunflower oil. Cedar-braised beans, which called for dried beans, water, a 5 or 6 inch branch of cedar, and juniper and salt. All sorts of interesting stuff. It sounds like simple recipes. There are more complex recipes, especially when you get into the proteins. So getting back to the question about squash, though it doesn't sound wildly off course, there's some interesting sounding things in here. We've got maple sage roasted vegetables, sweet and sour roast goose with autumn squash and cranberries, griddled maple squash. How about a maple squash sorbet with cranberry sauce? That sounds pretty good. That is something I think I would definitely try. Bruleed squash with blueberries. Squash and apple soup with fresh cranberry sauce. You can kind of see a theme here with some of the ingredients. But I was intrigued when I found this book to pick it up and give it a try, mainly for the squash inspiration. But as I'm going through this, I'm finding all sorts of preparations of beans, corn, different flours, nuts, and tubers and things like that. It's definitely a gaping hole on my cookbook shelf that I needed to fill, and there'll probably be more similar types of books on the way in the future. But this is a good starter, I think. The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen by Sean Sherman with Beth Dooley. I'll put a link in the show notes, but I'm also going to give away a copy of the book. It's a hardcover cookbook, 220 or so pages, tons of recipes, tons of interesting information on these indigenous ingredients, and lots of wonderful color pictures. So this is really a cool book. I think if you're in the North Plains region, the Dakotas, Minnesota, this would be a really cool book to have on your shelf. And even if you're not, if you're just interested in one of the very many different varieties of cuisine from the Americas, this would be a great book to pick up. Now, if you want to enter to win a copy, head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway, and there you will find the page where you can enter to win a copy of The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. All you need to do, at least, is provide your email address to enter, and this is simply so I know how to track you down. If your name is chosen, I'm not going to use that email to spam you or send you emails or anything like that. It's just to get in touch with you if you win. But I'm also going to include some other ways you can enter, like following on Facebook and things like that. So every time you do one of those actions, it'll put an entry in for you. I'm going to keep the contest open until the end of this month. So at midnight on October 31st, the last hour of Halloween here, the contest will be open, after which it will close. And then in the first couple days of November, I'll go ahead and draw the name and get in touch with the winner and then get this book in the mail to you. So if you want to win a copy of the book, again, kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Don't forget the show notes for this episode will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/218. In those show notes, you'll find links to the articles and the book that I just talked about here, along with all of my social media channels and the Nitty Grits Network links for the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. So if you want to check that out, you can head over there and see what other shows are on the network or just what kind of fun stuff the Southern Food and Beverage Museum has going on. Hey, you know, we took a year off of the Halloween episode last year of the show with COVID and scheduling. It was just kind of impossible for whatever reason to get it put together. But we are going to be doing one this year. So I know a lot of you are excited about that. So keep your ears peeled. That will be coming down the line in a couple of weeks. Tis the season. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the show. I really, really appreciate it. Once again, I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. And until next time, happy cooking.